From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, The Tick Code. We'll speak to jazz pianist Michael Wolff and his wife Polly Draper about their new film based on Wolff's life. It's the story of a musically gifted boy with Tourette syndrome. In addition to writing the screenplay, Draper plays the boy's mother in the film. Also, we remember Sir Alec Guinness, who died Saturday at the age of 86. He's known for his earlier roles in films like The Bridge on the River Kwai and later as Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton traveled to Idaho today for a look at the state's wildfires and a meeting with the workers who fight them. The president was shown the damage during a helicopter flight over the area. Later, he thanked firefighters who've been battling a big fire in the Payette National Forest.
I want you to know that your fellow Americans appreciate it. These fires have been very well publicized. And the American people know how they're being fought and who's fighting them. And you need to know that we're proud of you and we're grateful to you.
The president said he's also releasing $150 million in emergency funding for firefighting efforts. Democratic presidential candidate Al Gore introduced his running mate today at a rally in Nashville. Gore said that Senator Joseph Lieberman will break a historic barrier by becoming the nation's first Jewish vice president. The Reform Party's governing body has disintegrated just 2 days before the party's national convention is scheduled to begin. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The Reform Party National Committee came to Long Beach, California to consider a challenge to presidential candidate Pat Buchanan. But the seating of committee members descended into pushing, shoving, and yelling when competing state delegations fought to take part. Two camps, one pro and one anti-Buchanan, began screaming at each other. About 60 anti-Buchanan delegates finally walked out and started a parallel meeting about two blocks away. Each camp now claims to be the legitimate Reform Party governing body, and it now appears possible that two competing nominating conventions will be held later this week. It also seems likely that at least some aspect of the Reform Party's primary process will wind up in court. Andy Bowers, NPR News, Long Beach, California.
A judge in Hawaii has sentenced a former Xerox employee to life in prison without possibility of parole for killing seven of his co-workers last year. Hawaii Public Radio's Craig Da Silva reports from Honolulu.
Judge Marie Milk's sentence assures Xerox killer Byron Uesugi will spend the rest of his life behind bars. In court, emotional and teary-eyed family members of the victims lashed out at the man who gunned down their loved ones at the Xerox building last November. Uesugi showed no emotion and chose not to orally address the court. During the 2.5-month trial, Uesugi's attorney said the former copier repairman was insane at the time of the shooting. However, prosecutors successfully illustrated to the jury that Uesugi carefully plotted out the murders to take revenge on his co-workers because he thought he was about to be fired. Uesugi will be sent to a maximum security prison in Honolulu, but because of his high profile, he may be sent to a prison on the U.S. mainland for his own protection. For NPR News, I'm Craig Da Silva in Honolulu.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 110 points to close at 10,976 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq lost 4 points. This is NPR News. Iran's conservatives have closed the country's last major reformist newspaper and mobilized thousands of hardliners to protest against press freedoms. Reformers fear they've been deprived of an important forum as campaigning for next year's presidential elections gets underway. Dale Gavlak reports.
Iran's hardline press corps ordered the immediate suspension of the popular Bahar Daily, published by a close associate of reformist President Mohammad Khatami. Conservative-led state-run radio said the paper was banned in part because it published a so-called fake interview with a parliamentary deputy. It alleged that the reformists would try to reintroduce a bill to overturn press restrictions, effectively challenging a ban imposed by Iran's top leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Meanwhile, thousands of conservative Islamic militia members and bazaar merchants rallied outside parliament to back Khamenei, who they see as protecting the revolution and the Islamic system. They accused the press of colluding with foreign interests to restore American dictatorship in Iran. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
28 states are suing the music industry for allegedly forcing discount stores to raise compact disc prices 5 years ago. The suit, filed in a federal district court in Manhattan, says record companies threatened to stop giving the discount chains thousands of dollars for advertising if they didn't raise CD prices. The companies say they were forced to make the threat because some discount chains were selling CDs at below wholesale cost, forcing some record stores out of business. New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer said the suit aims to force the five major record companies to pay back illegal profits they have allegedly collected since 1995. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Barbara Bogave. That's Michael Wolff from his new CD, Impure Thoughts. Wolf is a jazz pianist and composer. He's played with jazz musicians such as Sonny Rollins, Cal Jader, and Cannonball Adderley, and he served for 5 years as the band leader for the Arsenio Hall show. Wolf also has Tourette syndrome, a neurological disorder. He's collaborated with his wife, actress Polly Draper, on a new film based on his experiences in these two different subcultures, the world of jazz and the world of a person with Tourette's. Their film, The Tic Code, tells the story of a divorced mother, Laura, whose 12-year-old son, Miles, an aspiring jazz pianist, has the disorder. Miles' symptoms include facial and whole-body jerks known as tics, also involuntary exclamations, coughs, laughs, and other behaviors. Miles idolizes a jazz saxophonist, Tyrone, played by Gregory Hines, who also has a mild case of Tourette's. Tyrone becomes romantically involved with Laura, played by Draper. Draper also wrote the screenplay and co-produced the film with her husband. Wolf contributed the score. Polly Draper has appeared on the stage and television. She's best known for her role as Ellen on the TV series 30-something. In this scene from The Tic Code, Laura and Tyrone are arguing about Laura's need to discuss Tourette's.
I don't think that it's odd that I'd want to talk to you about it once in a while. My God, I've watched my son be humiliated by it for years. And tomorrow's a really big day for him. His father's done half the humiliating. So, yes, it's on my mind.
What are you going to do, Laura? Just find more people with tics for him to meet? I hear there's a baseball player who's got him. Why don't you take him to a ball game?
Cut it out.
Jazz clubs, baseball games. You'll sit through anything, won't you? So long as you can eventually discuss your favorite topic.
My favorite topic?
The one with Miles and his tics. You never leave this f***ing apartment.
Stop yelling at me. Stop insulting me. I'm sorry I brought it up. I'm sorry you don't like to talk about it. But I have a little boy who goes to school every day and comes home calling himself a weirdo. And I can't help but be sorriest about that.
Well, let me pull your coat to something, Laura. He is right. People like me and Miles are weirdos. And the sooner he realizes it, the better.
You know what, Tyrone? You can call yourself anything you like. But while you're in my house, don't you ever talk about my son that way again.
Fine!
Polly Draper and Michael Wolff, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having us.
Michael, let's start with you. While the movie isn't overtly your biography, I imagine at least some of the incidents that are dramatized in the film come from stories you've told Polly over the years about growing up with Tourette's. How much did you two talk about Tourette's before making this film?
Well, actually, I have to say, when I first went out with Polly on our second date, she turned to me and said, "What's wrong with you anyway?" And that's the
first time.
Yeah. He claims I said it like that, when really it was probably very gentle and kind.
Yeah, well, I'm sure inside you meant it that way. But, you know, I'm sure I perceived it however I perceived it, because no one had actually ever said to me directly, you know, "What is that that you're doing? What's wrong with you?" People had obviously noticed it, because I at times have tics that are definitely noticeable physically and vocally. But nobody really just come out with it that straight. And I think it took me aback, but I did tell her that I had Tourette syndrome. And it was very hard. This was over 10 years ago when we first met. It was very difficult for me to to speak about it at all, and really hard for me to even deal with it myself, because I had never been diagnosed with having Tourette's syndrome as a child, and I didn't find out that what I did had a name to it until I was in my 30s, and a friend of mine's sister-in-law, who was a social worker and had two boys that had Tourette's syndrome, just said to me, by the way, do you know you have Tourette's syndrome? And I said, no, I don't have Tourette's syndrome. Then I said, what's that? And she gave me a book that Oliver Sacks, the neurologist, had written, and in one of the chapters he talked about a jazz drummer named, he called the chapter Witty Ticky Ray, about a really funny, wired-up guy who was a drummer on the weekends, and by the day he had a regular gig, and so on the weekdays he took his medicine, on the weekends he didn't. And I definitely recognized myself and realized, God, I guess there is a name for what I have. So it was very difficult for me to talk about it with Polly, and yet I was obviously, as we became more and more involved, something that came up and in various ways. And I think with Polly could probably tell, you know, I think friends of hers and her parents may have, you know, people often thought maybe I was on drugs, you know, speed or cocaine or something, because my movements were intense. And people do notice, you know, and you have to deal with it.
Gregory Hines, who plays Tyrone, the character with Tourette's, he's a jazz saxophonist in the movie. He doesn't want to talk about it. In fact, he describes Tourette's to Laura as something he doesn't like to talk about.
Doesn't like to talk about, right?
So, Polly, I know my husband had an untraditional and a not so happy childhood, and all I have to do to ruin a perfectly good evening is to dredge that up. So, how did you dare to tell Michael this is what you were thinking of making a film about?
Well, he had been encouraging me to write something, because I'd just been sort of rewriting all these other things that I had been acting in out of self-defense, and he thought that I really should write my own thing. And so when I came up with that idea, it wasn't just about the Tourette's, and I don't think the movie is just about Tourette's. What I really wanted to write was a really true and real mother and son relationship, because I think that in movies the mother and children relationships get short shrift, and I wanted to write something that was very real about what I thought was a really profound relationship. And that was what I thought of, because I saw Michael wrestling with this issue, and thought that it was an issue that I understood, and I bet you everybody, in my mind, everybody would understand, because I think there's something about all of us that we wish we could rip out of our body, which is what the little boy in the movie says. So I told him that. He thought it was a really good idea, but he didn't want me to write it because he was afraid what he considered to be a secret would be found out. What he didn't realize was that everybody sort of knew anyway. They didn't know if it was Tourette's or not, but everyone was noticing something about Michael, and they always asked me, and he had put me in a position where I wasn't allowed to tell anybody. And so...
Sounds reasonable to me, or did at the time.
So he didn't want me to write it, and so I said, all right, I won't write it. And then we had Thanksgiving dinner with his cousin, and his cousin's little boy had just developed these really severe symptoms of Tourette's, which... he hadn't had the year before at Thanksgiving, and Michael was really saddened by it, and sort of, I remember watching him stare at his little cousin, and with a lot of sadness, and he said afterwards, I think you should write it. But partly, I have to say also that a little off the Tourette subject, partly the whole Tourette's thing was inspired not by that more deep and sensitive thing, but by this one time when I was standing outside one of the nightclubs here with Michael and some of his band, who had just finished playing a set, and they were all standing there with toothpicks in their mouths, and they were all sort of arguing about jazz riffs, and going, no, it goes like this. And another one would go, no, it doesn't. It goes like this. And I thought, you know, all of this reminds me of Michael's tics. He was there ticking away and then singing and ticking. And I realized how musical his whole life is, that his, first of all, he hears music in his head all the time, and his tics sound musical, and here he was in the perfect environment for acceptance of his tics, because here he was making these sounds that sounded like jazz riffs anyway. And that's what really was the first glimmer that I wanted to use the Tourette's. And then I realized the deeper implications of it, and that's when I was worried that he might not like me to do it. But anyway, after he saw his cousin, he really wanted me to do it.
But I still didn't want her to tell anyone that I had Tourette's. Yeah. I was still under that fantasy that they would connect it.
Well, I can see this movie has even more of a backstory than I thought.
Yeah. Than you wanted.
Michael, do you see that kind of direct connection between your music and Tourette's?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Polly has often asked me about that, and she seems to see it. For me, I've only been who I am and have played music, so my perception of music is just my perception of music, and I'm pretty, you know, monomaniacal about the way I view music, I guess, so that when I've been asked this question, really just since the movie last year or so, I thought about it, and I guess if I were to really look at my playing from some sort of, you know, other position other than within myself, I would say that probably the one way that I'm different as a musician is that I do think I make leaps. I don't go along in a logical sort of progression of learning or logical progression maybe of even performing. I just try. I think it is impulsive, and things happen where I can sort of just glom some information. And I think there's plenty of musicians I've met who are brilliant and don't have Tourette syndrome, so I certainly don't think having Tourette syndrome is, you know, a requirement for being a great musician, though it looks like it's a good chance. I just spoke with a neurologist down, one of the head guys, Joseph Jankovic, in Houston, who thinks that Mozart did have Tourette's. But I think that, you know, I do think that there's something going on in my mind that's different. But again, since I've kind of been in denial about having Tourette's, I don't feel I'm identified as a Tourette's guy. You know, we say in the movie, Tyrone, the character, says, well, I don't want to be known as the Tourette's guy. You know, and I feel the same way. I didn't grow up with a diagnosis of Tourette's the way kids do now, and from 19 or 10 years old or whatever, so that to me, I wasn't a Tourette's person. I was just this guy that did this weird stuff, and I was a musician, and I played baseball, and I, you know, now I'm a father, and I'm this and that, and a husband, and also I do the weird stuff. So to me, it's just a part of me. But as I'm learning more about it, and I've gotten to be friends with Oliver Sacks, and I've talked with him about it, and he seems to think there's a big connection between the musicality with Tourette's and humor and sort of disjointed, surprising ways that you know, one and one doesn't equal two necessarily, or two and two doesn't equal four with Tourette's. Two and two can equal 43 or something. And I think that is, as I observe myself more and more from outside of it, I think that is the way it works with me.
In the film, Miles, the young boy who has Tourette's, he at one point stops himself from ticking, from his different physical mannerisms, and his mother, Laura, says, "Oh, I hate that. He looks like you're holding your breath." And he says, "I'm not holding my breath. I'm holding my emotions,
my feelings."
Yeah.
What does that is that a little bit? Is that what you're talking about? This emotionality?
Well, I don't know. You know, again, what I can tell you what I hate about having Tourette's. What I hate is that I can't help but appear vulnerable. Whether, you know, I don't feel I'm that sensitive of a guy, but I always got chicks because they thought I was so vulnerable because I was twitching and it seemed like I was all sensitive and stressed out. But truthfully, it just comes out in a physical impulse. And so I do tell all the young people with Tourette's, you know, men or women, hey, you're going to cop because, you know, you're gonna definitely meet somebody of the opposite sex because there is something appealing about somebody who seems to not be holding everything in. But I wanted nothing more as a kid than to be cool, you know, and that's the jazz thing. You know, when I grew up in the 70s, you just keep everything in, and, you know, I couldn't do it. So I hate that part that, you know, other people have things wrong with them, but it doesn't always show. You know, it's like with Tourette's, there's no way people aren't going to know about it.
You do something when you hold your phone. Well, it's interesting. It to me once.
It's interesting that you know, there's things that I've realized that I've tried to talk to other people about that they have no idea, and there are no words that I know in English or Spanish, which I speak a little bit, to describe what I do. But I have a thing that I can do where I can sort of push energy out to the outer reaches of my body by concentrating, and it comes out of my mind, but I can feel it in my legs and my stomach and my hands. It's the strangest thing. It's almost like I'm willing energy out. And there's a thing that, you know, when I've been on television, when I've performed, I'm able to do this and not have my tics or not having them show or to divert them. I think it's all about energy, and that's what Oliver Sacks says. You know, Tourette's is about energy, and it's focusing it or unfocused. And I notice when it most happens is when I'm driving or jogging or, you know, kind of my mind is wandering, and it comes like that. So I think that what I'm able to do is it's almost like I just go into a zone where I think I'll be the opposite. I will be like Polly described how I was at first with her parents, almost not there, almost catatonic, where I just have to turn everything off. And then I can contain, repress, suppress, avoid the ticking for a while.
My guests are Polly Draper and Michael Wolff. Polly Draper is an actress. She stars in the new movie, The Tic Code, which she also wrote and produced, about a single mother and her musical prodigy son who has neurological disorder, Tourette syndrome. The film is in part based on Michael Wolff's life. He also has Tourette's. Draper and Michael Wolff are married to each other. He's an internationally known jazz pianist. He composed the score for the film The Tic Code and also co-produced it. Let's talk more, Polly and Michael, after the break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Polly Draper and Michael Wolff. Polly Draper is an actress. She's best known for her role as Ellen on the TV series 30-something, way back when. Michael Wolff is a jazz pianist and recording artist. They've collaborated on the new movie, The Tic Code, which is in part based on Michael Wolff's experiences as a young boy with Tourette's syndrome. Michael, Gregory Hines, in order to play the role of Tyrone, studied you. Your tics, and you coached him, and also the actor Christopher, who plays the role of Miles. Mm-hmm. How did they do that? Did they shatter you for a day, or practice tics, you know, in front of you?
The interesting thing was, I think, you know, I never saw either of them do a tic. I think what they did was, I spent time with Gregory, and with Gregory it was really just more hanging out. Like, we went to jazz club, we have dinner, we'd have drinks, you know, whatever, just getting to know each other, and I think he was observing me all the time. And there was just one or two times when he asked me, well, if you did this, if you got mad, would you have more tics, or a few things like that. Gregory is really an amazing study and actor, and so I think he just observed me, and I have to say that he nailed it to the point of when I saw the first day of shooting. You don't shoot in order, but the first thing we shot was outside on East 10th Street, and in front of Tompkins Square Park in New York, and I saw him do a scene, and it's when he describes what the tic code is to a Robert Eiler's character, the bully Denny Harley. When I saw that, I almost just burst into tears because I saw myself, and it was a big catharsis for me to see that, and totally upsetting. I have to say, I was really angry, irrationally, at Polly for writing this thing. You know, why do I have to deal with it? I mean, it was so many emotions going on, but ultimately, during the 6-week period of shooting, I felt myself freed from my, you know, I would say probably at that point, 30-something years of denial of this condition. So watching Gregory really kind of blew my mind.
What did you see him do that was so affecting for you? Because he's pretty subtle in the movie. I mean, he coughs
like
a little bit, and he blinks a little bit.
Yeah, he shakes his head, he coughs, and the way he was hiding it, he did a lot of tricks. I have a lot of tricks.
Just like Michael.
How do you hide it? What are your tricks?
Coughing, playing it off as if I'm singing, you know, because a tick will kind of happen, and then I'll see it's there, and then I can, you know, have you ever you've seen somebody across the way, and they're waving at you, and then you wave back, and you realize they're waving to the person behind you, so you take that wave, and you bring it over and scratch your head. You know, or you do something like that to make it look like, oh, yeah, I was just reaching up for something. And it's kind of like that, you know, where I would start a tick, and maybe I'd reach back like I was massaging my neck, or I'd start to do a sound, and I'd turn it into a cough and put my hand in front of it, like Gregory does at one point when he's outside the club talking to Polly's character the first time. I mean, it wasn't too long ago I realized what I was in a store in New York, or, you know, a restaurant. I was ordering some food to go, and I just let out a whoop, you know, as a sound that I don't do that often, but it kind of came out. And this lady looked at me, and I looked at her, And, you know, there's always a question. Am I going to say, oh, I'm sorry, I have Tourette's syndrome? Then they're going to go, what's Tourette's syndrome? And, you know, I've got to deal with that. So, I just did what I usually do. I just looked at her and I just decided I wasn't going to deal with it. Maybe it isn't what I usually do. I didn't really try to hide it. I didn't say anything. I just said, well, I'm in the world. She can take it or leave it.
There's a neurologist that said to me, you know, people who have Tourette's just do what all of us want to do, but we have that pesky civilization that's kept us from inhibiting us from doing all these things. That it's when you hear some of these case studies, what these Tourette's people in extreme cases sound like is what we would be if we didn't put that one added dimension to ourselves of restraint. To me, part of why I found it so fascinating was that everyone who sees this movie finds it oddly familiar. And even though they don't have Tourette's, they sit there and say, ooh, why does this remind me so much of myself? And I think subconsciously we all have this, there's something going on with all of us that is being repressed, that is exactly what these people are doing. And I think everybody recognizes it. They also recognize what the Tourette's is a metaphor for in the film, which is, you know, people accepting things about themselves that they do wish that they didn't have.
To me, the whole metaphor, the whole way the film is put together with really the triumvirate of Tyrone's character, you know, Gregory Hines, Polly is the mother of the little boy, Laura, and Christopher Marquette. These are three people who basically, for whatever reason, feel very alienated from mainstream society, and they create their own little society in the jazz world of downtown village New York, where you can have an interracial romance, where you can be a little odd, you know. One of the huge things that made me so happy to get into jazz as a kid was I felt I was accepted if I could really play. And luckily I was a good musician and I could play, but what I liked was, you know, nobody was judging me. I was able to be with all different colored people. You know, some people were junkies, some people were whatever different problems we had. If you could play, that was what counted. And to me, I felt these guys that I met, particularly doing jazz, when I went on the road at 19 with this jazz vibist, Cal Jader, and I played with many, many great people, Cannonball Adderley and Sonny Rollins. And I had these guys who were basically my mentors. And while they didn't have Tourette's, they were all outcasts from mainstream society, and they were all great artists, and they all accepted me. And I think were even more drawn to me because of my having Tourette's and because of me having something that maybe made me have some pain and some soul that I was able to express in my music.
Michael Wolfe and Polly Draper are co-producers of the new film, The Tic Code. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember Sir Alec Guinness, who died Saturday. We'll listen back to a 1986 interview. And we continue our conversation with Michael Wolfe and Polly Draper. Their new film, The Tic Code, is based on Wolfe's life. It's about a young jazz prodigy with Tourette's syndrome.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue now with our interview with Michael Wolff and Polly Draper. They've collaborated on the new film, The Tic Code, which is based in part on Michael's experiences as a jazz musician with Tourette syndrome. Wolff is a well-known jazz pianist and composer. He wasn't diagnosed with Tourette's until he was in his 30s. Draper, who's married to Wolff, wrote the screenplay for the film and also stars as Laura, the divorced mother of a musical prodigy, Miles, who suffers from Tourette's. Polly Draper is an actress best known to television audiences for her role as Ellen in the 80s drama series 30-something. Michael, when you were a kid, did other kids taunt you or have nicknames for you? Did they notice your behaviors?
Not to my face. I have to say I was pretty lucky in that that didn't happen. But I think I got self-conscious about it in junior high school and high school when I became aware of my tics. So I think when I was little, I wasn't that aware of them. And so I remember one day I was walking in the 10th grade in high school in Berkeley High School in Berkeley, California, and there was this guy walking towards me. And I thought, man, this guy is making fun of me. He was walking funny and kind of jiggling around. And, you know, he's a guy who I thought was my friend. I went, God, I can't believe that. And it really upset me. And then a few days later, I saw him, and he didn't see me, and he was doing the same thing. And I realized he wasn't making fun of me. He just walked weird and did this stuff. But I was always conscious of it.
Now, you weren't diagnosed as a child. So did you have a way of explaining your mannerisms to yourself?
No, I really didn't have a way of explaining it to myself. I think I just felt bad about it. I think I felt like if I figured out what was really wrong with me, they'd go away.
How did your mother and father explain it?
Interestingly enough, my father was a psychiatrist, and we talked about it when I was in my late teens, and he told me, he said, you know, I know you have these tics, and I thought you may have Tourette syndrome, and I did some research on it, and I don't think you do because you don't have uncontrollable swearing. And at that time, which was in the 70s, I think the diagnosis was much more strict than it is now. Now it's just if you have a vocal tic and a physical tic together or separately, you're considered to have Tourette syndrome. So really, I think there had been other people in my father's family who had had tics. And my dad had a little eye tic when he was a teenager. So I think it was just, it's just the family thing.
Now, you started playing the piano when you were young kid.
I did, yeah.
And I think it was your father who got it into you. And I think I read somewhere that you grew up in Mississippi.
My father is from Indianola, Mississippi. My mother was from New Orleans. I grew up in Memphis for a while and in New Orleans. And when I was about 10, we moved to Berkeley, California. And then I spent my summers in New Orleans staying with my aunt, Nita, who's one of my favorite people in the world. And she could tap dance. She has perfect pitch. She took me to hear all this music when I was a teenager, and I used to sit in with people in New Orleans. And my father had perfect pitch, too, which means they can identify, they didn't know C or D or E, but they could sing the same note every time when they wanted to sing a song. So it was my father who really turned me on to the music because he loved Count Basie and Ray Charles and George Shearing. In fact, I thought all piano players were blind because he loved George Shearing and Ray Charles so much, and I just referred to him. You know, as a little boy, you know, 4 or 5, played the blind guys. So when I was 4 years old, he taught me St. Louis Blues on the piano, and they said the first thing I recognized was his whistle when I was a little boy, and I learned to read by having these little 45 records, you know, and I learned to read the titles and the artists on them. So I was just, you know, luckily, my father, who was a doctor, said, whatever you do, don't become a doctor. The stupidest people I ever met were doctors. Do something fun. Be a golf pro. Be a musician. You know, be creative. So I had a lot of support.
Polly, your performance in the scenes between you and Christopher George Marquette, who plays your son Miles, are really impressive. I'm curious whether you imagined that he was your husband as a child in order to make it real for you.
No. Nothing like that.
She doesn't feel that tender towards me.
It's not the same relationship. The relationship that my character had with Gregory Hines is much closer to what. But
it's what you kept telling me.
As a mother, I think that a maternal instinct is just a maternal instinct and has nothing to do with, imagining how your husband would have felt if he were a little boy. It's about what you would do to protect a child, no matter what his ailment is, or no matter what the situation.
Well, I remember once when Apollo, when our son was about 1 or 2 years old, and you told me you were at the park, and a little girl hit him or something, and she was 3, and Polly said, "I saw what you did."
She pushed him off slide, and she thought I wouldn't find out, and I went up, and I said, "I saw what you did." I thought, "Geez, Polly, get a grip. She's only 4." So,
she never came back to the park, that poor woman.
Polly, I know this is ancient history, but can I ask you about 30-something?
Sure.
While we're here, you played Ellen, who I remember as the nervous, kind of wild, really skinny, single one, who everyone loved to hate. Now, how did you?
Yeah, well, I would have been really skinny if I weren't pregnant during the Tick Code. I was pregnant during that whole time, so.
She's still skinny, and they love to hate her.
Yeah.
How did you feel about your character?
Oh God, it was a fantastic character. I got to do all the things that the other characters were too, moralistic and.
It was like your character had Tourette's.
It was fantastic. I got to say all the things that you know they wouldn't let Hope and Michael say because they were sort of the linchpin of the show, and I got to do all these things that people could say tut tut tut. She shouldn't be doing that, but. As an actor, so much more interesting to play than the goody-goody.
You know, 30-something, though, was so earnest and took itself so seriously, at least as a viewer, this was my feeling about the show.
Yeah.
And I imagine your fans took it very seriously, too, at least
they
at first.
Did. Oh, my gosh.
Did they approach you on the street as if you were Ellen?
Yes.
Still.
They still do. Mm-hmm. Well, especially when the character was having an affair with a married man, I was getting, even my aunts were calling me up saying, Polly, I think it's best that you stop that affair. Aunt Taffy, I'm not really having the affair. And so, yeah, they really bought, they believed it. And, but that, that to me, it's just, it was a wonderful role that I played. And, but when a show is really great and you do a good job on it, people identify you with that and think that that's who you are.
Well,
which I should take as a compliment.
Absolutely, and I was on the Arsenio Hall show as a band leader at the same time that Polly was on 30-something. We'd walk down the street and we'd have such different fans. And I remember once we were walking up 6th Avenue and a couple was following us and we were actually going to make a phone call and they came up. It was a yuppie couple and they said, "Excuse me, Miss Draper, but we just like to say we're such big fans of yours." And moment when you put your hand on Ken Olin's hand and you were in the bathroom and he comforted you, it meant so much to us. And Polly said, "Oh, thank you very much." And then we walked another block and a guy had a billboard that said, "Girls, girls, girls." And we walked past and he went, "Michael Wolf." So we kind of said, well, that's the difference right there between our fan bases.
Yeah, you got to cover all the demographics between the two.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, so many movies are revisiting a TV series. Do you see a 30-something revival movie or imagine it with horror?
I don't think that they're going to do it. We just had a 10-year reunion at the Museum of Television, and they asked that of Ed and Marshall, and they said no because it stood in this time and space that was so perfect for it and so right, and they wouldn't want to ruin that magic thing for it. The whole cast came to see me and to see.
Yeah, there was a reunion at the premiere in L.A.
So we had a reunion of sorts.
It was at a movie.
It was at a movie.
Well, Polly and Michael, I don't mean to beat this drum of Tourette so loudly, but I did want to ask you if your relationship changed then after making this movie together, or Michael, your perception or your relationship to Tourette's has changed.
It's totally changed. I'm now on the board of the New York chapter of the Tourette Syndrome Association. And I saw, hey, Tourette's is a good career move, man. I'm going to swing with it. I mean, this jazzing wouldn't get me too far. But, it's totally, I have to say I'm not 100% just, hey, I'm a Tourette's guy and I'm happy. It's painful. It's something I had shame for so many years. It's like, I'm not used to even being open about it. And, I sometimes forget, now I'm being open about it. Because this movie forced me out of the closet. Like I said, when I was on the set, and it was the first time I had met other people with Tourette's, and I met the people with the Tourette Syndrome Association, and I saw, wow, it's really important for me as a person who's been successful, who's been on TV, who's somewhat in the public eye, to embrace this and, I'm trying to mentor other kids and show them they can be successful. And we just got an email of a kid who, in Houston, who who heard us talking about on the radio talking about the movie, and he was 9 years old. Actually, his mother emailed us and said he has Tourette's. He just lit up on the radio hearing us talking about it, and his mother's going to let him go to this movie, which is rated R, and he's so excited to do it, and he was so proud that somebody with Tourette's was actually talking about it. So when I've seen, you know, what it can do, I've just, whatever uncomfortableness I have about it, I just have to push aside. So I feel that Polly gave me this great gift. It was painful. Part of me is still a little angry that I've had to be open about it, honestly, because I am still ashamed of it. But, you know, 90% of me is so relieved that I can just be in the open about it and know what it is and figure, you know, people can take me or leave me, you know, and having these weirdo things that I do, as I say in the movie, is part of me.
Polly Draper, Michael Wolff, thank you so much for talking today on Fresh Air.
Oh, so nice to talk to you.
Polly Draper and Michael Wolff's new film is The Tic Code. Michael Wolff has a new CD out. It's called Impure Thoughts. He's currently on tour with his band by that name. They play the Burke Fest in Great Barrington, Massachusetts on August 12th and go on to perform in Rochester, New York, Pittsburgh, Washington, D.C., and Pasadena, California. Coming up, we remember Sir Alec Guinness, who died this past weekend. This is Fresh Air. Sir Alec Guinness died on Saturday at the age of 86. Critics dubbed him a master of disguise for his ability to perform a wide range of roles, sometimes even within the same film, as was the case in his depiction of eight different members of an eccentric English family in Kind Hearts and Coronets. Guinness's other memorable roles included Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars, a bank clerk turned criminal in the Lavender Hill Mob, and Colonel Nicholson in the 1957 film Bridge on the River Kwai, which won him the Oscar for Best Actor. He played a British commanding officer who just arrived in a Japanese POW camp. In this scene, he meets some American soldiers who are considering an escape.
Of course, it's normally the duty of a captured soldier to attempt escape. But my men and I are involved in a curious legal point of which you are unaware. In Singapore, we were ordered to surrender by command headquarters. Ordered, mind you. Therefore, in our case, escape might well be an infraction of military law. Interesting?
Yes, interesting point. I'm sorry, sir. I didn't quite follow you. You mean you intend to uphold the letter of the law, no matter what it costs?
Without law, Commander, there is no civilization.
That's just my point. Here, there is no civilization.
Then we have the opportunity to introduce it. I suggest we drop the subject of escape.
Terry Gross spoke with Sir Alec Guinness in 1986.
Do you remember any lasting advice that you got in your early years of acting about enunciation or breathing or speaking lines?
Oh, many, I think. But I think all advice is something to discard sooner or later. When I first used to go and have... I was trying to get a scholarship to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and I went to Martita Hunt, who was an actress, and she formed my taste, I think, a great deal. And when she heard me reading, one of the kind of little... rule of thumb that she gave me, where she said, you know, for heaven's sake, never put the emphasis on an adjective unless you have to, or an adverb. Go straight for the verb, because that is the driving force of the sentence. Now, it doesn't mean to say that every time you speak a verb, you've got to plug it. But it did form, I think, the basis of my own appreciation of speaking, of listening to people. And I hear nowadays so much false emphasis, not just in the theatre, in fact, not so much in the theatre, as on railway stations when they tell you, you know, they say that in England, you know, they'll say the train for such and such a place will leave from platform. And you think, was there any doubt about it? And you get confused instead of them just saying, the train for such and such a place will leave at such and such a time. And
you joined the Navy in World War II. And I wonder if it gave you any ideas about acting, because you were exposed to so many different kinds of people and different experiences and different cultures as you sailed around the world.
Well, I think part of the title of my rather odd book, Blessings in Disguise, lies in my naval experience, insofar as if it hadn't been for the war, and God knows, you know, we can do without wars, I would no doubt have stayed in the West End Theatre in England. I would have moved with many delightful people, pretty frivolous, pretty light-headed, always concerned about what was next happening in the theatre. Well, the war came as literally a bombshell. I was just starting on what looked like a promising career, so it was a bit wretched to say goodbye to that. But it moved me for the next few years among people whom I was unlikely to meet, not from the point of view of observing them or what they were like, but getting to know men on the lower decks, and then later on I became an officer, and realizing that the world wasn't just theatre. On the other hand, I had to perform as such, and I never knew what I was doing quite as a naval officer, and I was in command of a little ship built here in Quincy Yard in Boston. And so I really acted being a naval officer, or my idea of what a naval officer might be like. And I've always maintained that was the best performance I've given. I mean, it wasn't a very impressive one, and it was a very very junior thing, but it was a long run.
Several years after the war, you started making movies. Did you say to yourself, I want to do movies now?
No, it wasn't that. I'd never been particularly interested in movies. I don't know why. I'd loved going to them, but I'd never sort of thought of myself as going into movies. I thought I probably hadn't got the right face. But at the very beginning of the war, I had written a stage adaptation of Great Expectations, which was performed, and I was in it. And that was seen by David Lean and Ronald Neame, who were working together then. And at the end of the war, 1945, beginning of 46, they were going to make a film of Great Expectations, and they remembered seeing me, and I was still in the Navy when they contacted me, saying, you know, would you like to come and play that part you played on the stage on film? And I'd always rather thought, if ever I do a film, the first one must be something that I've already played in the theatre, so at least I know what I'm at so far as the character's concerned. Then I can put myself in the hands of technicians. And that's what happened.
What was your reaction when the first time you saw yourself in a leading role in a movie?
Well, I don't know. I think I was rather sick. I would have seen the dailies, as they're called, we call them the rushes in England, of Great Expectations, and was horrified at what I saw. But David Lean was very keen that his actors should see the rushes. So for the first few films I made, I always did. And I suppose I learned something. I learned not to fidget or twitch or some little mannerism which was creeping in. Now, or for many years now, I never look at them. I mean, I never look at the dailies.
You say you were horrified at the beginning when you looked
horrified.
At them. What horrified you?
Oh, I couldn't believe. It was something nauseating up there. I couldn't bear it.
You think that's a typical reaction that people have when they see themselves, especially if they're used to acting on stage?
Well, I have some people. I've caught seen them watching themselves, and I've seen their faces suffused with pleasure.
In 1949, you made the movie Kind Hearts and Coronets, and you played eight roles. I think it was eight. You played an entire family in it. It's a really funny movie. Whose idea was it for you to play all those roles? How did that come about?
Robert Hamer, who directed it, who was a brilliant creature, alas, dead, invited me to play two of the victims in it, I mean, two of the family. And I was on holiday in France, and I read the script lying on a beach, and I laughed within two pages of it out loud. hurried through the rest of the script and thought, but it's ridiculous to play two. Either play one, which I can understand, or the whole lot. So I went to the post office and sent off a telegram and saying, you know, love the script, but how about me trying to play all eight? Which there could be a reason for, a family likeness. And to my joy and delight, they said, yes, fine, try it.
Alec Guinness talking with Terry Gross. Here's a clip from Kind Hearts and Coronets. Guinness plays General Lord Rufus Descoigne, a member of a titled British family. All eight members of the family are played by Guinness and systematically killed off in the film. In this scene, the general is dining and is about to be the next victim. The first voice is that of the narrator and killer, played by Dennis Price.
It seemed appropriate that he who had lived amidst the cannon's roar should die explosively. I therefore concealed in a pot of caviar a simple but powerful homemade bomb. And through the post, I sent the caviar to the general.
I pretended to be deceived by the feint and sent our horse to meet it. At that moment, the concealed enemy emerged from behind the kopje. I held our guns fire till we could see the whites of their eyes. Used to get a lot of this stuff in the Crimea. One thing the Ruskies do really well.
Not an atom of him was left.
A scene from the 1949 film Kind Hearts and Coronets. We'll hear more from Alec Guinness in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1986 interview with Alec Guinness.
You did The Bridge on the River Kwai in 1957. Did you know as soon as you read the script you wanted to do the role?
No, not at all. The first script I read, I didn't care for at all. I thought it was not terribly good, and I turned it down. They didn't want me in the first place, that I found out as I started to film it. They wanted either Charles Laughton or Noel Coward, I believe. However, for various reasons, which I don't know, anyway, it came my way, and I said, I really don't quite see it. And the script was rewritten, not on my account, let me hasten to say, but it was, I think, David Lean, who directed it, thought there's a lot wrong with this, and it was rewritten. And when it was rewritten, you know, Sam Spiegel easily persuaded me to play it, although I'm not sure that I ever quite believed in the part.
What? Why not? What gave you doubts?
Well, he's such a blinkered man, you know. He's in such a narrow focus on life. I find it hard to be sympathetic with him. There are people like that, of course, but it didn't make for easy playing.
Do you feel you have to be sympathetic with a role in order to do a good job in it?
No, not sympathetic, but you have to have some sort of empathy of saying, well, I can understand that man, and, you know, that could be me or something. And I didn't quite feel that with Colonel Nicholson.
A role that you almost turned down, the way I understand it, was the role of Obi-Ben Kenobi in Star Wars. What, you saw the script? First?
Yes, I don't know. I've heard this before. There was no question of me turning it down. I was doing a film in Hollywood, Murder by Death, and I think it was about the last day of shooting of my work on it, and suddenly there was this script on my on my makeup table, and I saw that it was George Lucas who had made American Graffiti by that time. But I had to rush off and work. And I said to various people, tell me what you know about George Lucas. And they all said, well, you know, that's a real filmmaker there, although he hadn't done anything tremendous. Got back, saw that the script was science fiction. I went back with enthusiasm because it was George Lucas, saw it was science fiction and thought, well, that's not for me. I mean, I'm not that sort of... But I bet, because it's Lucas, I better read a few pages and see what it's about. And I found myself turning the pages with alacrity. I didn't think the dialogue was very good. In fact, I thought it was rather bad. But the story held me. And so when I'd finished it, I contacted Lucas. We'd lunch next day, and I was very impressed by him. He was very quiet and very sensible. And I indicated, yes, I'd love to do it. I've never turned it down at all.
You die in the first movie. Did you expect that you'd actually still be returning, nevertheless, for sequels?
No, I suggested that I should die when I did, and that I should be removed from the film because, I mean, I can say it now, I didn't dare at the time, I thought that the part which went on to the end of the film deteriorated and was less interesting, and I thought if I can go out rather spectacularly, that's all right, but I don't want to fizzle out.
Do you consider yourself to be one of the actors, I'm thinking here, one of the Gielgud, Richardson, Olivier actors?
No, I'm not in the same class. That doesn't worry me. I've never tried to be. I'm my own man, which may not be very impressive, but it's the best I can do. I'm happy to admire them, and indeed many others. But I'm about, as I said, about 10 years younger than that particular brilliant and strange group of actors. And therefore they're always, you know, when you're 20, you see those other people up there at 30, or in their 30s or something. That's the sort of, it's possible. And they remain always above you.
You've written about this constant conflict that you've had on the one hand, being equally repelled and attracted by the spotlight, is the way you said it. So you think you found your balance?
No, it'll never be a real balance. It'll always be shifting from one foot to the other, I suspect.
Sir Alec Guinness, he died Saturday. Suze Boland directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Book Division, publisher of Dr. Murray's Total Body Tune-Up. Slow down the aging process, keep your system running smoothly, help your body heal itself for life. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the film critic grills the actor. Roger Ebert talks with Willem Dafoe. We present a special interview that took place at this year's Cannes Film Festival. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.